Chip Brown has written a book about a life both tragic and well-lived. It's the story of Guy Waterman, who left a career as a Republican speechwriter, an unhappy marriage, and a history of alcoholism. Guy Waterman left all that behind after he discovered mountain climbing in 1963. Later, with his second wife, Laura, he would constantly range through the mountains of the Northeast, even in the dead of winter. But Guy Waterman lived with immense sadness. Two of his three sons disappeared while living in Alaska, one, maybe both, apparent suicides. And 3 years ago, on a winter's night at the age of 67, Waterman chose to end his own life on a New Hampshire mountaintop, to die by exposure. In a note to a friend, he wrote, "There's much about this world that's too much for me." Writer Chip Brown describes the happy times, too, the times when Guy and Laura Waterman were busy on the homestead they built way back in the woods of Vermont.
People would joke it was right out of the 17th century. They did everything by hand. They cut all their wood that they used to heat the house by hand. They hauled all the water that they used by hand. There was no electricity. They grew all their own food by hand using no, motorized harrows and plows. They had extremely exact, they kept great records, mostly because Guy was a fantastic record keeper. He would count the number of blueberries they picked from their blueberry bushes. So he was able to say in 1998, for instance, that he picked 43,000 blueberries. It was part of the granular existence, you could call it, I suppose.
What was that compulsive side of him that would make him count the number of books he read to Laura, the number of blueberries they picked?
Well, in a phrase, I think it was sort of the rage for order. I think that in some sense he had created a world that was completely ordered in order to contend with the fundamental disorder of his life, the disorder of being out of control as a drinker, the disorder of families that are kind of disintegrating. And he fought to create this sort of garden against the kind of chaotic, tangled, and confusion of wilderness.
He is... extremely methodical and maps out his death very carefully. He climbs Mount Lafayette to scout out a spot where he will ultimately die. And the role of his wife, Laura, is fascinating in this. She knows about his plan to kill himself for more than a year. He's told her that he will do this, and she's essentially living with that hourglass for so long. What did she tell you about how she lived with that knowledge for so long of what he was going to do?
She did participate or collaborate even, but she didn't have very much choice. I mean, she had no economic independence from him. She couldn't change his mind, and she saw her collaboration as a kind of act of love. I mean, this is something he deeply wanted, and he was very grateful to her that she did not oppose him.
You describe their final encounter together based on, I guess, conversations or letters that you had with her. And I wonder if you could read from the bottom of page 286, the part beginning at the window.
At the window, Laura could see that Guy had forgotten his father's ice axe. "Guy!" she shouted and ran out onto the porch. She handed him the axe. She stood rooted there, no shoes, no coat in the zero-degree air. There she stayed as he thanked her, then set off, shuffling down the hill, paying out a line of tracks behind him. He turned at the bottom and raised his arm. A last wave. She waved back, and then the forest took him in, and he was gone.
Guy Waterman hikes up Mount Lafayette. It's 5,200 feet. It's the middle of winter, and dies alone on the mountaintop. You've climbed up that mountain, and I'm wondering
Yes.
if you've imagined that scene of him up there. He's got some stuffed animals in his backpack. He's got a little whiskey, two alarm clocks.
Did I imagine? Oh, I went to the spot where he died and stood there and tried to imagine what it was like to do that. It was six below and the wind was blowing 100 miles an hour. And he had worked up quite a sweat from the climb. He timed it so he arrived exactly at sundown. He apparently did scribble some lines from Paradise Lost on the back of his map. And he had the stuffed animals in his pack, which I also found extremely poignant. You have to feel for him at that moment. I mean, he, for whatever judgmentalism or condemnation you might make of the record of his adult life, at the end there was a kind of innocence as one steps into one's death.
His suicide is deliberate in any number of ways. He had contemplated other ways that he might end his life, one of which was he thought about jumping off the mountain, and he decided not to do that.
He tried to jump off. He couldn't do it because his whole training as a rock climber was oriented toward not falling, and the idea of losing control in that way. I mean, in some sense, this is all about control, and to step off a cliff is the ultimate act of someone out of control. But whereas to sit down in a 6 degree below zero, 100 mile an hour wind, there's something, I hate to use the word gentle, but it's a much more gentler form of dying than to be smashed to bits at the foot of a 600-foot cliff, you know. So the method he hit upon was very congenial to his sort of sense of being the author of this act, and his whole notion of adding himself back to the land that had given him so much, but in a kind of tender way. I mean, you know, I'm using words like gentle and tender to describe brutal temperatures in a body that it becomes as hard as marble. But when you think of the methods of dying, there is a kind of fierce tenderness to freezing to death at sunset on the mountain that you consider almost holy.
I'm sure all suicides are complicated and often mysterious. Do you come away at the end with a clear understanding of what led him to do what he did, to take his life this way?
I think he sentenced himself to death. I think he condemned himself in some ways. I think he felt guilty about the kind of record he'd left as a father, about his own genetic complicity in his son's unraveling. And, you know, and I think there are probably psychopathologies at work, a kind of narcissism maybe, but also there is a kind of nobility at work. And I think it's the fact that these can coexist, great nobility and great narcissism or great suffering at the same time, that make him such an interesting person and actually warrant the sort of invasion that a book like this is, or I hope it warrants it.
It seems so in keeping with the way you describe Guy Waterman's methodical nature and his deliberateness that at his own funeral, he has recorded himself playing piano certain songs that he wants people to hear at his funeral.
There was a deep streak of vanity in him, and his vanity, and not only his vanity, but his sense of wanting to control his environment and his circumstances was posthumous. It went into the church, and he wanted to prescribe the service, and so he recorded the songs that he wished to be played, and he specified some of the readings that he hoped would be read, and sure enough, they happened. They came to pass.
Well, Chip Brown, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been great.
Chip Brown is the author of the book Good Morning, Midnight.